Hey friends, so today's program is going to be a little bit different, but I want to convince you that you should give it a listen, and here's why. I was scrolling Instagram one day a couple weeks back thinking, what more can I do to be part of the solution these times? You know, with all this shit happening in the world, and I knew that one of the things that I really wanted to bring to people's attention was the subject of Islamophobia, right? So I ended up getting connected to this person by a mutual friend, and I ended up hosting this live with an expert on Islam and my friends. Wait, you're like, wait, why are we talking about this on your podcast where you normally talk about marketing? But listen, this was like no other live I've ever done before. It got an explosive reaction. It got more likes and more views by a wide margin than any other live I've done before. And that's saying a lot. And not just from like Muslims, from all kinds of people. And you might think that a conversation on this kind of subject might be too intense or too dry or polarizing, but it wasn't. It was actually so absorbing and interesting, and honestly felt so good in my heart that so many people actually watched the entire freaking 55-minute long interview, like on Instagram. How many times have you sat down to watch an entire 55-minute video on Instagram? I've never done that, but guess what? Lots of people did, because this interview was that good. Imam Ahmed Deeb, who I talked to, was that good. It was actually a first-time meeting, and he was honestly one of the most beautifully eloquent, intelligent and soulful people that I have spoken to like ever in my life. Honestly, I remember I got off this interview and I was telling my husband, I just met the most extraordinary person. And I thought we were just going to talk about Islamophobia, but I feel like what we really got was an education on being human and loving other humans. And he speaks beautifully, not just about like as a Muslim, like quote unquote, his people, but the need for compassion and love towards everyone, and fighting bigotry against anybody, in fighting anti-Semitism, because all of our liberation is yoked together. This is a really powerful conversation. I encourage you to please give this a listen. You are going to fall in love with Imam Deeb just as hard as I did.
Thank you so much for being here. For anyone who might be coming from your world and have never met me, my name is Simone So. I live in South Korea. I say I'm a marketing teacher, but really what I think I teach is how to be human. I mostly teach by modeling through a very messy example. I'm the host of a podcast called I'm Your Korean Mom. And I feel passionately about learning how to think better and relate better in the world. And so this topic is important to me. Okay, now on to you.
Thank you so much. All right, I love your story. And you know, your story is a very beautiful story of intersectionality, right? Like you have your profession, you have your expertise, but naturally it bleeds into so many other areas you're passionate about. And I'm no different. You know, I'm an imam by training. I'd studied this faith, funny enough, in Cape Town, South Africa. So a lot of people, when they think, you know, where did you study Islam? Well, first of all, we have many institutions in America that do that. But we also have institutions abroad. So when I tell people Cape Town, I lived in Cape Town, and it's why the Palestinian cause is so dear to me, because I saw the effects of post-apartheid. I can only imagine what apartheid must have felt like to live in. I'd studied, my undergrad is in psychology. I went abroad to study Islam. I did my master's degree in Islamic studies. And hopefully within the year, I'm going to be finishing my PhD in community psychology. So that's kind of where my expertise is.
Super. Super cool. Now, this is a safe space for dumb questions, right?
There's no dumb questions. Okay. This is a safe space for questions.
So, I have to ask first, because I know I'm not the only one wondering, what exactly is an imam?
Okay, great question. The word imam simply means leader, and it's a particular type of leader. Usually in America, it's used to describe someone that leads a congregation of Muslims, usually within a mosque setting. Even though they're a congregation of Muslims, in other forms of institutions, you know, the concept of like a third space and other spiritual informed institutions. But in a mosque, you know, that's what an imam is. Someone who's leading the pastoral care and educational needs religiously of their congregation in a mosque.
Is it something they have to study and qualify for? Are you appointed an imam, or are you self-declared, I'm going to be lead and I'm going to be an imam?
Well, I'm so glad you asked this question, because, you know, it's one of the crises that we're dealing with, you know, is that because of social media, it's so easy to self-proclaim as anything, right?
True.
And I think that's frustrating for every profession, you know?
Yeah.
Similarly, in my profession, yes, you have to have rigorous training. And, you know, the best imams, they don't just go to school. They don't just attend a seminary where they learn all of the quote unquote subjects that you need to qualify as an imam. They also have a form of residency, kind of like physicians. So they have a training and a mentorship under, you know, spiritual guides that teach them, okay, you learn all this stuff, here's how to apply it though. Because, you know, in your field, I mean, it's in every field is like this. You can learn a bunch of stuff, but the application with the very real hearts and the pain of people is a completely different reality, and it's almost its own training.
Yeah, it's like apprenticeship to apply what you theoretically learned.
Yes.
Okay, so I just had to get that out of the way because I was wondering.
No,
was
I'm glad. I'm glad.
I can guess, but I don't want to be wrong. Okay, no, so I really wanted to have this conversation because I think this, I have not seen this conversation in the mainstream, like at all. Mm-hmm. And the conversation about Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism. And it's interesting because everybody knows that Islamophobia is a thing, obviously, right? In the post 9/11 world, everybody's like, I mean, if you're like a basic, decent, good person, you're gonna have an awareness that Islamophobia is bad, racism against, you know, Muslims, bad. But that's probably as far as your awareness is gonna go.
Yeah.
You're probably not gonna know that much about Islam. This myself included, like I have some of my dearest friends are Muslims. I have had like countless friends, you know, who wear hijabs, who are very faithful. I mean, actually the entire spectrum, I have like non-practicing Muslim friends and very faithful Muslim friends. And I'm like, yeah, it's supposed to be a religion of peace. Like billions of people practice it. Don't be prejudiced against it, but that's kind of it. And because of our awareness is so shallow and most people aren't curious. And I have to say, I myself, I just assumed, oh, I don't have Islamophobia. I have Muslim friends. I respect Islam. Like all religions are blah, blah, blah. But I didn't, my internalized Islamophobia wasn't really challenged until I started following a lot of Muslim accounts on Instagram of all places. Wow. And I was like, wow, I guess I had these prejudices about certain things. And I think a lot of us just don't interrogate it. And when we don't interrogate it, we let our implicit internalized Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism just run amok. And so that's why I saw these prejudices run amok in all the conversations about the Middle East, all the conversations about Palestine. It contributes to dehumanization of Muslims and people in countries where that are majority Muslim. And there are, you know, stereotypes and prejudices that like we are vaguely aware that we have, but also don't really challenge, like Muslims are inherently like violent or they're terrorists or, you know, they oppress women or like all these kinds of things where we're like, yeah, that's probably like a hateful prejudice, but also I don't really know the reality, right? So that's why I wanted to invite you to cut through all of that and to begin to do each of our own work in challenging our internalized Islamophobia as well as some of the ways we might participate in perpetuating it in the world by the kind of things we say out loud, by the things we do. So that's why I wanted to host this conversation. So in your words, why is it, might be such a basic question, but why is it so important to be aware of Islamophobia and anti-Muslim racism?
Thank you so much. Well, I mean, I want to begin by truly thanking you for creating space for this. Not only as a beautiful human being that's committed to humanity and peace, but this is like extra special as someone who faced anti-Muslim racism their entire life, growing up in America. I grew up in a post 9/11 reality. So there wasn't a year of my life till now that I wasn't facing some sort of discriminatory behavior as a result of that racism, as a result of this Islamophobia. And, you know, I guess I'll define it in a bit, but I want to answer your question directly. Why is it important? Well, the first off, we live in as Americans, at least, we live and as a global village, we live in what they're terming the global village, right? You know, and you have marketing background, so you know how central that is. And in a global village, everyone is now your neighbor, everyone. And so I think we have to revive our own humanity by witnessing and realizing that our commitment to this, it should be a prerequisite to a truly flourishing sense of humanity, right? That my neighbors are hurting, I want to understand why. You know, if you told me, like, my neighbor here, I love my neighbors. If you told me, like, one of them is going through the toughest time in their life, and you said, it's because of, and you gave me a word I don't understand. You know, my first instinct should be what? Well, I don't know what that is. I need to go and check up on them. And I knock on their door and be like, hey, neighbor, are you all right? I heard, you know, you're going through this, something because of this. I don't know what that means. I just want to be here for you. So that's the first thing I want to highlight, is that we don't want to immediately politicize everything. Our lives are political, yes. Everything that we do carries political weight. But I think it's important for us to reflect, like, we're also human beings. And we're in a time where I feel we're actually losing our humanity. We're quite literally, you know, Stephen Colbert. I love Stephen Colbert because at the end of every show, he's like, stay human, everybody. Stay human, everybody. And, you know, it's like a nice line. And yet now we're witnessing, like, quite literally a genocide before our eyes, the most televised genocide in human history. And many of us are still unable to be empathic and say, let me see what's going on. Let me at least check what's going on. My neighbor, human neighbor, seems to be hurting. That child had nothing to do with this. Why are they being killed? Let me go and check up what's going on. The second, which, I mean, this was a great segue, I think, accidentally, to the second reason. What we have to understand is, and I speak on behalf of, as an American, I don't know the realities of other lands. I speak on behalf of America because this is where I come from. This is where I was raised. And as an American, so much of the foreign policy, any committed human being to peace would despise, so much of that is motivated by this rhetoric. The war on terror, by the way, that was created in 87 in a conference in Israel. I mean, people don't know this. And this war on terror, you know, it is claimed close to 2 million Iraqi lives, innocent lives, on the basis of what? On the basis of a lie that was told about these people, these savages, these people. And the only way we're going to get rid of, you know, the savagery that they exude is by colonizing them, is by going to war, bringing them democracy, which, What did that mean? Killing 2 million people unjustly on the basis of weapons of mass destruction that never existed? Weapons of mass destruction, you know? So what people have to understand is that a lot of the realities that we are so disconcerted by in the world, are actually motivated by Islamophobic and anti-Muslim racism.
That was such a moving, compelling answer. I love your reminder in the beginning to not immediately politicize everything. It's about our human neighbors. And how many Muslims are there in the world? Like,
a lot. I mean, that's worth one fifth of the population.
Yeah, one fifth of the billion. Population. Yeah. So at least a billion. And that is a huge part of our human community. It is like one in five of our global neighbors are Muslim. And that also means that when a group is that big, there's going to be huge heterogeneity. There's going to be huge diversity in how people are and how the faith is practiced. And so it, my takeaway is really, it's good humaning 101 is to be, to interrogate your own Islamophobia, right? It's like, hey, let's not be shitty to our neighbors, right? Yeah. By not turning a blind eye to their, so much of their
experience. Turning that into a verb. I love that so much.
Humaning. Yeah, because Colbert is like, stay human, keep being human, right?
I love
we
it.
Have to keep being good humanity. Yeah, okay. So now let's get into the real stuff, which is, what are some ways that anti-Muslim prejudice and bigotry and racism shows up in the West? Actually, let me stop there. How does it show up?
That's an excellent question. I think before we even answer this question, what we have to do is define what we're talking about. You know, in the Muslim faith, this is very much stressed, that you always begin a conversation with definitions, because you don't want to assume beliefs of someone that they may not have on the basis of a incorrect definition of what they're saying, right? So let's agree on the definition. Let's first start with the term Islamophobia. A phobia is an irrational fear. It's understood as an irrational fear, and Islam is Islam. So Islamophobia is an irrational fear of Muslims. Now, for all of those tuning in who are not Muslim, I want to tell you, all of us have prejudice and implicit bias. So you can breathe. It's okay. We all have this. We all exhibit it. Anyone who's been even a remote student of psychology knows the implicit bias studies are crazy. Like, there's all of us exhibit this. We all have bias and prejudice, right? And it manifests in certain ways. Sometimes it manifests in like it's never harmless, but it's just like a thought. It's like, I shouldn't have that thought, right? So it's important to understand that, because when we think about Islamophobia, the things that come to mind when you think of a Muslim, that's what we're talking about. And we have to be honest with ourselves when we ask that question. When I think of a Muslim, what do I actually think about? And you might, you know, I give you some answers. Oppressing a woman, you know, a big bearded guy that can barely speak English, is yelling all the time, frowns, no smiles. These are the images that have been, you know, institutionalized. And so it's normal for people to have those ideas. Now, those ideas motivate or animate the way that we treat others. And that's Islamophobia, right? It is this idea of the irrational fear of the other. Yeah, the irrational. And, you know, I should have done that. I see in the comments. I actually wanted to, but I was afraid we didn't have enough time. I wanted to ask you guys, and if it's okay with you, can we still do this?
Of course.
Okay. I want to ask you all in the comments, when you think of a Muslim, what do you think of? Just be honest. Just be honest, okay? The comments are for us, for this conversation. They're not going to be saved.
Yeah. You know, they're not going to be saved.
Profile. We're not a screenshot. You know, just be honest. What comes to mind when you think of a Muslim? One of you said, everything is forbidden in Islam.
Everything is haram.
You know, and growing up, we had a slang term that said, you know, when you said, yo, that suit is haram, it meant like it's forbidden for you to wear because it's so nice. All right. Big extended family. Gardening and plants. Okay, that's wonderful.
Judgmental.
Okay. Oh, okay. Forcing, a coercion in the faith. Judgmental. Okay, very good. Any other answers? Okay. So, you know, let's take all of that and recognize that they may not be true. That's the first step to having this conversation. They may not be true, abusive. Yeah. And so the reason why it's called Islamophobia is because there's an irrationality to some of this fear. Meaning, if someone told you, like Simone, if I told you, you know, your next door neighbor is actually someone who hates animals. Right? And you're like, oh my God, how could anyone hate animals? That's a reasonable response. Now, it's irrational fear of that person until you go and investigate, right? Is it true? Does this person actually hate animals? And so the Islamophobia is an irrational fear of Muslim on the basis of prejudices that were informed by myths. And we talked about how that shows up, you know, or why it's important. You know, it shows up in mainstream media. I've given you some of these images. Now, what I want to say is this. Why is Islamophobia not enough as a term to describe what's really happening? Mm-hmm. Why are we also using anti-Muslim racism? I'll tell you why. When you think Islamophobia or a phobia in general, like a spider, okay? It's like you have an awkward relationship with spiders. You know what I mean? Like you have a phobia of spiders. You see them, you freak out. You know, we've seen all these reels and memes about this, right? Like we're very strong until we see a spider. So what when we think of the fear of Muslims in that way, what we might assume is that there's no systemic institutional element to this. That we might think, oh, Islamophobia is just an internal, interpersonal prejudice of other Muslims. There's no policy, governmental reality, system of oppression that actually puts these out there and structures society in that way. That's why anti-Muslim racism is so central as a term, because like racism, Islamophobia is systemic. Like racism that historically, until this day, disenfranchises Black Americans and institutes policies towards their disenfranchisement and discrimination, the same exact thing happens to Muslims. And it's important for people to know also, close to 35% of Muslims in America are Black Americans. So, you know, this is central to our story from an even different angle, from another layer. And so when we define that, and is there anything that you want to say before I continue with how it shows up?
Go ahead.
So now that we understand that, no, this is system-based oppression, well, how does it show up? Well, there's the interpersonal element of hate crimes, right? More Muslims in America report discrimination than any other group in America. Muslims are consistently of the highest people who experience any hate crimes in America, right? Muslims and Jews. And that's why as Muslims, we're against anti-Semitism, right? We have a similar struggle. And even if we didn't experience the same thing, we're still against anti-Semitism because these are morally wrong. And so in addition to hate crimes, what are the systems that are in place that accentuate a culture of racism towards Muslims? Well, we talked about the war on terror, and these policies, our foreign policies, are motivated by the dehumanization of Muslims. And this, you heard it when George Bush wanted to go to war with Iraq. You know, we gotta go and bring them democracy because they're not as human as us, they're not as, you know, cool as us, and you know, we need to go and colonize them and kill their children in order for them to be given democracy. I mean, this is the type of colonization and imperialism that still exists in America, and is motivated by some of these policies. In addition to that, everyone knows about Trump's travel ban, but it wasn't really a travel ban. It was a Muslim ban. Because all you look at those countries, those are all Muslim, for the most part, Muslim majority countries. Why are they systemically, why is their policy that systemically disenfranchises them to say that immigration for you guys is different, right? For you guys specifically, immigration is going to be different to protect our country. How racist is that? In addition, we have what people don't know is that there were literal laws like the Patriot Act that were instituted that basically normalized surveillance and racial profiling of Muslims.
It's like encoded racism, like racism made into law.
Exactly. In other words, I used to, as an imam and still today, I'll make jokes about it. I'll sometimes say in a sermon, like, you know, we welcome our FBI agents here that are trying to entrap our young people, because, you know, like sometimes satire is the only way to do it, right? Like sometimes you have to exhibit humor, because we know these realities. FBI agents were funded, their careers were to go into mosques
and entrap other Muslims. In fact, I had this experience as a 21-year-old. I had a conversation with an FBI member that was close to the mosque. We knew he was an FBI because, you know, mosques across the country, despite the systemic racism, actually have a great relationship with those people, right? A skeptical one, and it should be that way. The FBI was never the friend of social justice. It wasn't a friend to Dr. Martin Luther King. It wasn't a friend to Malcolm X. It wasn't a friend to the Black Panthers. And so, you know, I went for coffee with him, and it was such a, it was a lovely coffee like date. You know, I was a 21-year-old. I was like, I was still naive. You know, I didn't know much about America and the world. And, you know, I was just asking about his job. I was like, oh, that's cool. And then he asked to meet with me again. And the second, you know, date at Starbucks, which was supposed to boycott, we were there, and he said, after, you know, the pleasantries, he said, he brings out a manila folder. And he says, hey, you know, I just want your thoughts on this. Do you know these people within your community? What are your thoughts on this? What are your thoughts on that? And immediately I was, even as a naive 21-year-old, I was like, yeah, this doesn't feel right. This feels like he wants me to say something that's gonna put me in trouble, right? And this is all well documented. There's actual surveillance cameras paid by tax money to spy on Muslims. There's racial profiling where you go to try to fly till this day. Simone, I'm not making this up. Till this day.
Oh, I believe.
Even though I have been committed to peace building in the local community my entire career. Okay, I've been doing this since I was like a teenager. My father was an imam. My whole life was this. Despite that commitment to peace, till this day, I cannot travel internationally without the agent, you know, whatever airline, say, actually, wait, and then they give a call. And then I have to wait for another 20, 30 minutes just to see if I'm cleared to leave the country. And when I'm back, 4 hours interrogation. My most recent interrogation was in Fort Lauderdale. Not only was I interrogated for 4 hours, my phone was taken away, and I was stranded without a phone, couldn't call my family, in an airport for another 12 hours until the next flight. I lost thousands of dollars because I had a work trip, and there's no consequences to this. They'll just keep doing this. And these systems go back to the interpersonal prejudice. So I remember being on a Southwest flight. Imagine this, I was on a Southwest flight. I wasn't wearing this hat. I don't always wear this hat. I didn't look too visibly Muslim, okay? And I was on a Southwest flight, and I needed to use the restroom, so I used the restroom. I was in the restroom, and then I hear the flight attendant like knocking. And she's like, you need to exit the restroom, sir. I was like, okay, I wasn't even there for a long time. I was just making ablutions for prayer. That was it. So I was like, just give me a minute. And then I heard even louder knocking. Sir, you need to get out of the bathroom. And I was like, what in the world is going on? A minute later, they barged into the bathroom. I'm not making this up. They evacuated me out of the bathroom, forced me to sit. I was walking with my shoes because my shoes weren't even on as a result. I was making my ablutions. I sat. And this isn't even the craziest part of the story. It was a connecting flight. And in the connection, do you know what the pilot and the executive, one of the executives of Southwest, and the flight attendant who was racist to me, were all there. And I said, do you think this is acceptable? You know, to just kick me out of the, what was I doing? I was following guidelines. I said I was going to be out. Do you know what the pilot told me? He said, we didn't know your intentions. As if I'm here making a bomb in the bathroom. Why would you assume anything other than me using the bathroom? I told you, the flight attendant allowed me. And it was the same flight attendant who lied and said, no, I didn't allow him. So this is the way it shows up. We have an entire program in America called Countering Violent Extremism. I don't know if you've heard of this, where the government gives a bunch of money to mosques and religious institutions, and it might seem like, oh, this is a good thing, but what is it called? They're called CVE grants, Countering Violent Extremism. The idea embedded in that very grant is that you guys have a specific terrorism problem.
No, you guys have. You have a specific.
Yeah,
there's something inherently terrorism-y about mosques and Islam, so we gotta keep tabs on you.
Exactly. Yeah. And we'll give you this money, but in taking that money, what are you doing? You're normalizing the systemic oppression. You're saying, you're right. We are inherently radicals and terrorists, whatever that means. You know, Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist until 2008, even after he won the Nobel Peace Prize. America still considered him a terrorist. Until 2008, Nelson Mandela, the great figure. So they use these terms, and you'll take this money, but you're gonna normalize that you guys are what we say we are. And this is, by the way, someone, you know this is the colonialist playbook, right? You could be a Muslim, you could be a Jew, you could be a Korean, but only in the way that I tell you is acceptable,
Otherwise you're a threat to our security, yeah.
Otherwise you're a threat, and you know, we're going to have to criminalize you. Another way this shows up that might people don't know, I had an account with PNC Bank, and you know it was a business account, and I go to the bank to pull out some money for you know something I was working on for a venture, and they said, "I'm sorry, you don't have an account here." And I was like, "What are you talking about? Of course I have an account here." I said, "No, you don't have an account. It was closed." And so I was like, yeah, but I never received a letter. I never received an email that you were closing my account. And they just closed my bank account without informing me for no reason. And interestingly, when I went to go and demand, they said, okay, they will give you your money, but you have to sign this paper first. The paper essentially said you can't sue us. And then we'll give you the money. And by the way, this is all documented. Nothing I'm saying is personal experience. It's not a one-off. It's well documented that not only is there a watch list for Muslims trying to fly, there's a watch list, there's a blacklist of Muslims that banks circulate, and they have the ability to just close your bank account. And you essentially, you can't, and they're supposed to notify you, but you can't do anything about it. So even banks, it sounds like redlining, right? It's like Black Americans trying to get a loan, but because you have a Black name, you're less likely to get a loan. This still exists in America. Some of these exact same policies are associated with Muslims, not to mention media representation. There is a systemic effort to paint Muslims in a particular way. So for example, if I told you, Simone, let me ask you, what do the majority of Muslims in America look like? What comes to your mind?
Honestly, I've had so many Muslim friends and they look like all kinds of things. So it's hard to say they look like
this. That's the right answer. right answer. Now, let me ask you a follow-up. What do Muslims look like in the media?
Oh, they always have distinguishing, you know, features. You just call what you're wearing a hat. I don't know if that's the right
name for it. Have the hat. See, look, I have hair, guys. See, it's not forbidden for me to not wear the hat. But
hair, in hijab, you know, head cover, face cover. They're wearing traditional clothing. They're never in like, you know, a suit or just normal casual clothes. They're always visually distinguishable.
Interesting. I'm really glad you said that. And before I even continue, obviously, women can dress in a way that they want. Men can dress in a way that they want. If women are choosing to be covered, nothing, we have no moral authority to say that somehow is less normal, right? But media does represent Muslims in a way that in the status quo of what is normal in culture,
yes,
they're opposite to that.
Yes. Yeah?
So it's always someone with an accent, which is hilarious because it's like a lot of us grew up here, and there's nothing wrong with an immigrant with an accent. That's not a. But what is the constant message? They're frowning. They maybe can't speak English properly. If they show a woman, you know, she's covered in a way that's intentionally jarring, even though it's acceptable for the American public. All of that to do what? To otherize Muslims.
Yeah.
You'll never ever see, rarely ever see a Black American Muslim faiths represent the media, despite the fact that they represent close to 35% of our community, and despite the fact that Islam is the most religious, diverse community in America. Yeah. Did you know this?
Many Muslims look like me, face-wise. Yeah, there's, you exactly. know, there's Asian Muslims, dark Muslims, like every kind of Muslim in between, and it's always depicted in a certain way that erases that diversity.
Precisely. Yeah. And you know, the largest Muslim nation in the world is Indonesia. Yet, when you watch the media, you think every Muslim is an Arab,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
With a, you know, big beard and can't smile for some reason, yeah. right? The funny part is, Arabs are barely 12% of Muslims across the world.
Wow.
And it's shocking to people when I say this, because that is the only image in movies, not just on CNN and Fox, but you go to movies, it's always the terrorist. And this was, by the way, the savage terrorist didn't come after 9/11. Movies in the 70s and the 80s depicted Muslims in the same way, these savage Saracens, right?
And also Arab... going back hundreds of years too, right? In Europe, they would depict, you know, Arabic, you know, all, they're either, you know, exoticized as the other, or they're depicted as somehow like, you know, savage and less than blah, 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 you know, in spite of the fact that the Arab world gave Europe a lot of its civilization.
Precisely. And I think, I mean, that's that defeats, you know, when I share these, I'll end with this, Simone. When I share this, I usually share some of these facts with, you know, people in my community that aren't Muslim. You know, we used to, when I was working at the mosque, we used to have a yearly cultural festival with diverse food and bring animals. And I'd bring these facts and I can see there's a sincere, genuine shock people don't know what to do with. And the reason why is because they're like, why would this happen? Why such systemic misrepresentation of Muslims? Well, because it's so much easier to go to war with people you have dehumanized and otherized. It is so much easier to go, and remember, America for a large part is a war economy, yeah? Wars make us money. You saw, you know, there was a, I don't know if it was in the Wall Street Journal or something, but, you know, as the genocide in Gaza is happening, there are these investment experts that are saying, well, make sure to invest in these weapon stocks because we expect
this to continue.
You saw that, right?
It's like, hey, make sure to make money off of people dying.
Exactly. Making money off people literally being indiscriminately killed, innocents being indiscriminately killed in Palestine by an illegal occupation, as described as such by international law. And so, you know, this is why this happens. We shouldn't be naive as to why this happens. And as you all have seen, this is just the tip of the iceberg as to the systemic racism that Muslims have to face on a regular basis. And I didn't even mention the interpersonal stuff where a woman wears hijab and has to walk in fear. Is someone gonna rip it out? Is someone gonna, like one person, they burned her hijab as she was walking, right? I had someone recently, I was invited to the community psychology conference, the Midwest EcoCon, one of the largest community psychology conferences in the country. It happens every year. And I was talking about, you know, the silence in academic spaces about Palestine to highlight the double standard, the systemic racism that exists. Like, we talk about land acknowledgement for Native Americans, but we don't see that it's the exact same thing as happening in Palestine. They were indigenous whose lands were stolen. They were dispossessed, indiscriminately killed, et cetera, et cetera. So I was talking about this, and one of my colleagues who is from Southeast Asia, she's an international student, and she started getting choked up talking about her experience because she said, it's actually terrifying for me to even discuss this because I may get deported, and it is hard for me to even wear the hijab. I've been wearing the hijab, she said, my whole life, and yet for the first time, I'm even questioning, like, is it safe to continue wearing my headscarf in American society? This is the real world effects, not to mention the hate crimes like Wadia, the 6-year-old child in Chicago, a child stabbed 17 times just because he was Palestinian. And the perpetrator, for him, Arab-Palestinian means Muslims. Muslims are all terrorists. I have to kill them. It is my patriotic duty to do something about these Muslims. So, you know, we ask God for healing and peace, but these are just some of the ways that this stuff shows up. Yeah, sorry, that was a lot.
That was perfect.
I apologize.
No, please, that was perfect. I think this is so important for us to begin to learn about, because even if we don't know all of it, even if just having learned what you just said, we can begin to interrupt our own internalized racism, and we can begin to interrupt other people. Like I think it's so crazy how in normal conversation, a lot of things that people, like nowadays in polite society, people don't say things like, oh, well, Black people, or well, yeah. Jewish people, yeah. But people still will say overtly prejudiced things about Muslims all the time, and it's still politically okay, like a lot more okay than other forms of bigotry that people like have more of an awareness of. And so when somebody else says something like, oh, well, you know Muslims such and such, then you can say, hey, actually that's not true. Exactly. You know, and you can arm yourself with facts, and you can you know, begin conversations that create more opportunities for people to see Muslims as human. So that all this is so important. And you, like,
Simone, I just want to say you made such an excellent point, which is that, and it's two points that you actually made that I just want to highlight. The first, one of the unintended consequences of this, or I mean, it's unintended for us,
right,
is the idea of internalized racism, which is that Muslims begin hating themselves.
For sure.
Right? I remember when I was in seminary, I was just like, man, why do I hate studying Arabic so much? Like, it's not language. I love language. And Arabic, I'm a native speaker. It should come easy and natural for me. And when I really dug deep, I was like, why is it so emotionally difficult to be studying Arabic? I realized because my entire life, I've been watching movies that make it seem like the language of these barbaric people I want nothing to do with, right? These uncivilized people that I want nothing to. So even me as a seminary student, Simone, I was actually facing this, not to mention other ways that it manifested in me and many other young people. But the second point you made was excellent, which is that we're not saying, oh, Muslims are, we're not gonna overtly say Muslims are terrorists, but there are subtle ways that we may allow for things like it. I'll give you an example that just happened. I posted about it. Rabbi Shmuley, he's the most famous rabbi in America. He's considered the most famous rabbi in America. He posted this profoundly racist photograph, which is like a stock image of a Muslim woman wearing hijab. It wasn't an Israeli woman. It was a stock image. The same woman was used to market Indonesian skincare products, which was hilarious. And it said, yeah, I know, it's really funny. This document, the photo, it said, I can go to university. I can become a doctor. You know, I can be educated. And this is because I live in Israel. And you know, you might think, oh, that's great. But in reality, what is the message? The message is, all you Arabs oppress women. You don't even educate them. But in Israel, even though it's a Zionist, you know, illegal apartheid regime, we're great with Arab, you know, we treat them beautifully. The great irony of all of this, and just to highlight how much of the propaganda about Muslims are complete lies, Palestinian women are more educated than Israeli women by statistics. In fact, Palestinian women are some of the most educated women on the face of the earth. The literacy rate in Palestine is 96%. Our literacy rate in America is like 76%, right? So not only is it offensively racist, the racism is built on a lie. It's built on a myth that we have normalized because it is convenient to the foreign policy interests of America rooted in this war economy that we mentioned?
There's this great comment about we treat Muslim women better than their own. It's this arrogant behaviorism. And I think that's the perfect word. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm the internet, yeah.
Yeah, it's the saviorism of, oh, we have these civilized high standards, and if you come to our side, we'll treat you, you know, and you barbarians, they're over there. It's racist.
Yeah.
And I don't think, because I guarantee you, so many people in the West will look at a meme like that and unthinkingly think, oh, well, thank goodness for Israel, you know, for saving the rest of the barbaric Arab world. You know, that's the narrative that these memes, media narratives continue to feed. And here's what I want to stress to everybody who is learning about this, alongside me as a non-Muslim, right, is that we don't recognize a lot of these as racism because it's still socially appropriate, it's still politically not that incorrect to be Islamophobic, to have anti-Muslim racism, right? And you see the evidence all around in the way that the you know, current genocide is covered. Just Muslims are just a little bit less civilized, just a little bit less human than the rest of us, and all the images that we see of brown Muslim people are of destruction, and you know, women crying in hijabs, and you know, destroyed buildings and wreckage and war and bombs, and it's like, you know, that these people didn't have bombs and destroyed buildings and crying women before the West went in. Like, we did that.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
And these people went
all the
to
while.
School, yeah.
No, I'm sorry, Simo. Keep going. No. I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, everything you're saying, and in the meantime, we're using iPhones.
The algorithms of which
were built by Muslims. Like, the entire science algorithms
was invented by Muslim civilization. Most of the stars are named,
by Muslims who led the field of astronomy. I mean, this is the actual reality, but when we're not exposed to that history, it's very, you know, I saw a quote today, which is like, it's very easy for us to live in the present in a way that undermines the importance of the past, right? We're always distracted, right? And
yeah.
And so, you know, this is what I'm seeing in the media, therefore it's true. And I think now for one of the first times in American history, a mass populace is waking up. They're like, no, you cannot continue peddling, you know, Zionist propaganda that disenfranchises Muslims, that does not tell the true story of the Palestine-Israel reality. You know, the study, I said that women are so educated in Palestine, the news article that highlighted this, which was featured in major news media outlets, mainstream media outlets, they used UN numbers. And they said, the only thing that stands in the way, essentially, I'm summarizing, is the bombs that fall on these schools by this occupation. And so now Americans are like, no, you can't just say this about Muslims. You also can't just say this about Jews. You can't just say, oh, a Jewish person criticizing Israel or Zionism is a self-hating Jew. Or that is anti-Semitic. It's the same thing we talked about. It's a colonial tool of, you could be Muslim, you could be Jew, but you have to be that according to my terms, according to what I deem acceptable.
Yeah. Okay. I could personally keep talking to you for hours and hours, but we do have to close at some point. You are so brilliant, and everything you said, it just, it's like so, I don't have the right words for it. I'm just such a huge fan. If people want to continue their education, besides continuing to follow you, and you do these weekly lives where people can learn more about Islam, and that I know, and I'm sure you have more resources, how would you recommend people to deepen their learning beyond this conversation, to keep up their activism against anti-Muslim racism?
Sure. I promise I'll only take like 45 minutes to answer this, okay? Just kidding. All right. Now, as I answer that, here's what I want every single person to know. That is that is supported by these resources. Okay, what do I want people to know? Number one, a lot of the myths, I'm just gonna debunk them very quickly.
Okay.
Muslims are violent. Muslims have the lowest crime rate in America. Trump said radical Islamic terrorism is the greatest threat facing America. The hilarious part is this. Statistically, you are more likely to get killed by your own toddler than you are by a radical Islamic terrorist. It's statistically insignificant. It's 0.00005% of a threat. And yet, how is the previous president emboldened enough to say it's the greatest threat facing America? In addition to that, Muslims in America are the most philanthropic community in America. We are givers, and we want to give. We want a better America. We want a just America. We're committed forever to that pursuit. In addition, we have the highest entrepreneurship. We have the highest educational attainment for women. Oh, Muslim women are oppressed. We have the highest educational attainment for women in America as Muslims. And I can give you fact after fact after fact just to tell you, I want you to feel comfortable believing I have been told lies. And when they weren't lies, they were insidious half-truths. Now, what are the resources? I'm going to make it so easy for you. When it comes to statistics on Muslims, there's a place called the Institute of Social Policy and Understanding. ISPU. It is the great research organizations that are, it's led by Muslims, but it surveys Muslims and beyond. And they have the most accurate statistics on the realities of Muslims and what they're facing, and debunk some of these myths about the facts, myths about Muslim experience. The second resource I want you all to memorize is called Yaqeen Institute, Y-A-Q-E-E-N Institute. Just Google it. Now, here's what I want you to do. Whenever you hear like Islam was spread by the sword, okay, I want you to go into Google and just put Islam is spread by the sword, Yaqeen Institute. And you'll get an accurate, intellectually honest debunking of the myth. The myth is actually a crazy myth because
it's so funny from Syria. I'm a Christian and I'm like, oh, you know what other religion was spread by the sword? Fucking Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well,
like, that's crazy.
And not only is that, no, you're absolutely right. But the funny thing about this is that it's a complete lie. You know, I'm ethnically from Syria. In Syria, it took, under Muslim rule, 300 plus years for it to become a majority Muslim land. Now, let's just be real. If we were trying to forcefully convert people or ethnically cleanse them, would it take 300 years?
No, it would not.
I mean, that's just silly, right?
And also, it's people like convert to Islam like every single day out of their own will. I just see it
fastest
all over.
Growing religion in America.
In love with Islam and they convert. Look around.
And more and more people are falling in love with Islam, thanks to you for bringing accurate representations of Islam. I can't thank you enough. These are the two resources I recommend for everyone. The third resource is you're welcome to DM me. I'm the crazy person who answers their DMs, unless they're weird. I will block. But
I am not.
I do my best. I do my best. Yeah, it's getting harder and harder. But, you know, I'm more than happy to answer any of your questions. And in fact, for those who are interested, every single Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern, I go live to answer any questions people have about Islam and Muslims. So that's a resource, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for creating a genuine safe space and providing this opportunity. Believe it or not, we don't get it a lot. A lot of, you know, what I was exposed to hearing growing up was, where are the moderate Muslims? Which is such an objectifying label, right? But let's go with it. Why are the moderate Muslims not speaking out against this and speaking out against that? And we're all like yelling. We're all just like, dude, we're talking about it all the time, but you never give us the mic. You're always putting people in the media that don't represent us. If you actually came to mosques, if you actually spoke to a Muslim, you would realize We're talking about this stuff all the time. We're criticized. We're profoundly self-critical as a community because God tells us that. God says in the Quran, be just and be committed to justice, even if it is against your own self. And so, you know, I want to thank you. And I want to say for everyone watching, the best resource beyond these academic ones is to go meet a Muslim. I promise you, you're going to have probably the best food of your life. And your entire fear will dissipate because you will realize it was irrational to begin with.
Yeah, your prejudice can't survive meeting an, you know, actual human being. And I always joke, like, you know what's going to happen when a lot of Muslims move into your neighborhood? You're going to have a ton of great food.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Your kids will be safe. You know, yeah. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Okay. I think you're like the most intelligent, eloquent human being that I've met, just like period ever of like any kind. So I'm just so like, woo! I'm like on a high from having been able to host your generosity, your intelligence, your thoughtfulness, your kindness, your humanity. My goodness, what a treat it has been. And I am so heartened to see how many people have been watching this whole time, participating, learning. We're all going to continue our learning. Thank you, Imam. And I hope to speak with you again. And thank you, everyone, so much for joining us.
It's an honor. And Simone, someone asked in the comments if we're able to keep a recording. I'm fine with that.
Absolutely.
If you're fine with it. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to keep it. Yeah. Absolutely. We're going to keep it on our grid so you can watch again.
Okay. Gracias.
Okay.
Thank you all for listening.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.